conversation. And just introduce yourself and then take us forward.
Thank you, Chair. I'm Audrey Kroblin. I'm presenting the Banking Association today, and we really appreciate the opportunity to address the portfolio committee in addition to the submission that we've handed in a couple of weeks ago. Just by way of background, apologies, I plan to have used the overhead projector, but I believe we have some technical challenges. So I will refer the committee members to the handout, which is a slide presentation of the Banking Association. By way of introduction of the Banking Association, for those that are less familiar with the work, it is an industry organization, has 32 odd members, commercial banks. Banking Association of Baza is fully behind and next to government in many instances and subscribes to the promotion of enablement of a conducive, competitive and a sustainable banking sector. And as such, also support and subscribe to government's initiatives, and specifically with regard to this amendment bill, I think it's fair to say that BASA and its members, by and large, in general, support the amendment bill, with the exception of the few issues that we will be discussing or that I'll be highlighting today, as well as the issues that we addressed in our submission. But by and large, we don't see any major hurdles. I think for us, it was identifying practical issues that we would like to highlight and perhaps say, let's look at maybe rewording or understand the full impact of even the unintended consequences of some of the things that I will be referring to. So, if we then, sorry, that was basically page one of the presentation. Two general comments in terms of clause 8. And what we've done is we've taken two or three clauses that are our main, where we want to really try and influence the process with our thoughts on those, and the rest are contained in the submission. I think we are feeling quite strongly that an emolument attachment order must really be the last resort, because it's such an invasive action. And we've heard, and just sitting there listening to various presentations and the discussion around that, I don't think any one of us has any doubts about the damage and the impact emolument attachment orders have on people's lives and their families and their futures. So banks by and large feel that should be the last resort. You should have done many other things before you get there as a creditor. Or we suggest maybe you should have been in default for at least 90 days before you resort to an emolument attachment order. And then we also urge the legislature to maybe consider that when a court needs to look at the quantum of the order, that due cognizance must be taken that it doesn't include the induplum, or doesn't fall foul of the induplum rule, which means that you charge more or less double. And then, as a general, in terms of clause 8, we ask, please, once the emolument attachment order has been granted, let that judgment creditor inform the registered credit bureaus of the not only one, all of them. The specific reference to section 65J1A, and we're looking at slide number 3, it will take some time to develop systems to accommodate the 25% cap. We are saying 6 to 12 months, so please take that into consideration. Now, will you have more than one emolument attachment order? The amendment says, please have a look and make sure that they don't push 25% of the salary. So, practically, we're saying, right, if this last one is now going to push over the 25% the salary, so what must the employer do? Is there a ranking system? Are you looking at this unsecured EAO, there's a secured one, and then there's SARS? Will we get guidance in that regard? What should be, and then if this last EAO was not, well, is not one that pushes over 25%, and the employer, employer of the garnishee doesn't adhere to requirements of that EAO, will the credit, the garnishee then be in contempt of court? We are a bit concerned about with owners in more than one way now being put on the garnishee or the employer to do a variety of things. We're a little bit concerned, not a answer, but just concerned as to how this will be done in practice. So, for instance, how will you, as a garnishee employer, verify the information of contained in the emolument attachment order if you don't ordinarily have access to that personal type information from the employee? So we are saying that the judge and creditor should actually provide as much of the information as possible. On page 4, carrying on with clause 8 of the bill, and with section 65, and still in the scenario of garnishee or employer being tasked with new things. We are also asking, what is the law speaks to salary? Are we talking about net salary or gross salary? Maybe these are just points that one, you know, that we want to part and highlight to the drafters, and it will, if we are able to get the clarity now or write it in law or through regulation, we will really be able to make life a little easier in time to come. On page 5, or slide 5, we're looking at section 65J6A, sub A. Now, they're really talking about a means test that must be exercised by the garnishee, and we are familiar with the fact that the court has the ability to do a means test or a financial test, and there's so many various terms used in the different pieces of law, for instance, in the Irish speak about suitability assessment and all those good things. So what we're thinking to hear is, can we perhaps just get a bit more clarity around what is meant by the means test, and how should this garnishee employer actually exercise or do the means test to establish if the person who has to be served is able to afford, or 25% at least. Right, let's move on to page 6. Still, it's dealing with section 65J. So, it introduces a sanction for the garnishee or the employer if one of two things happen. Either is not done on the salary, or secondly, you don't stop deducting from the salary once the emolument attachment or the judgment date has come to an end. So we're saying that might be a little bit harsh. In big organizations, the payroll processes are quite complex, and sometimes there are delays and they're not monitoring. So consideration should be given, and maybe allowance should be made that the word reasonable might find its way. Well, that's not written down. I'm just thinking about it. Maybe one should just make provision for the fact that the garnishee should take reasonable steps to avoid this, and that the sanctions should not necessarily be harsh because of circumstances beyond their control. And we are of the opinion that the judgment debtor, or the judgment creditor for that matter, should have the ownership to provide a garnishee with sufficient notice, and that's on page 7, to start and continue with the deductions or to stop with the deductions. We're just not sure how it will work when the garnishee has to be responsible for most of the administration around this, and want to make sure that both the judgment debtor and creditor are both party to the information sharing regarding the deductions that has to continue also. On page 8, I think clause 8 was just described was basically our main concern maybe with other questions. On clauses 2 and 13 of the bill, on page 8 of the handout, we are saying that the word judgment debt may be interpreted to exclude interest on the judgment capital and the permitted cost. So we ask you, can we perhaps just define judgment debt to be clear as to what it all includes, which will be obviously in our interest to include interest and other permitted costs. And then we just suggest further that the board should only be permitted to grant the relevant rescission of the judgment if the judgment is not subject to review or appeal, and reasonable effective proof of the settlement of the judgment debts attached to the rescission application. For example, a certificate obtained from judgment creditor.
Bearing in mind that review and appeal only cost, whereas rescission would reduce those costs.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The judgment creditor must be served with a rescission application. And not only notified, I think we quite sure there was quite some debate around this, specifically in view of our recent experiences with our postal services and the fact that we know not all our population is reachable through electronic means. So in addition to that, the complications of serving. So our suggestion stands that the judgment creditor must be served with a rescission application and not only notified of the intended application to ensure that the creditor is aware of the application. We are of the opinion that that will assist in alleviating some of the frivolous applications and some of the fraudulent applications. On page 9, we continue our recommendations on clause 2B and also clause 13. We're suggesting that the notice period might be changed to 10 days for both notice and the shutdown periods. This would permit the judgment creditor to actually have a proper look at the application and to verify the statement. But in the matter, we are also suggesting that proof of service then must be attached to the rescission application. Moving on to page 10, we're almost done. Can't believe the bank has so little to say about the piece of legislation, which is very good, on page 10, clauses 4, 5, and 6. We find that we have a view that the court investigation into the reckless lending and affordability assessment should be limited to the credit agreement in terms of which a judgment has been granted or the EAO has been requested. Other credit providers must not be drawn into the proceedings for the court because this will delay the process and it will lead to the incurring of additional costs. And this brings to clause 4, and the same will apply to some extent, 5 and 6. So, coming back to clause 4, we're saying that maybe the clause in its current format creates legal uncertainty, as it is unclear what the effect of an offer will be, which is made by the judgment debtor, if there is no documentary evidence available. and whether such a situation will preclude the judgment creditor from accepting an offer. Would it mean that the clause be amended to clearly illustrate that if the judgment creditor can proceed to accept the offer, made by the judgment debtor, if there's no documentary evidence. And then lastly, our comments on clauses 5 and 6 are very similar to that of clause 5. And we are of the opinion that other credit providers should not be drawn into a specific issue regarding emolument attached to order being granted in respect of an identified credit agreement or similar instance. Thank you.
Very much. Honourable members, there is a short, sweet, straightforward presentation. Honourable Leon.
Yes, thank you, Chair. Thank you for the presentation. I have a few comments or questions. On slide 2 there, in the written format, it's stated that the debtor or judgment debtor should be in arrears regarding the debt for at least 9 months, and then verbally it was amended to 90 days. If you can just have an explanation, first of all, as to what the real suggestion is, and secondly, what the rationale is after this. The balance of the presentation quite rightly say that EAOs are ultimately, hopefully, a last resort to get unwilling debtors to pay. So I'm not quite clear in my mind how a time period will assist the process of debt collection in any event, as long as the court are sure that there was an unwillingness to pay while being able to pay. And then the fourth suggestion, Roman letters 4, where the judgment creditor should be obliged to inform all registered credit bureaus of the granted EIO, I also fail to understand, first of all, how that duty can be placed on the judgment creditor. In ordinarily, these credit bureaus collect data regarding judgments from the clerks of the civil court themselves, so it's not necessarily the judgment creditor informing them of judgments. And secondly, I don't understand why we should burden debtors with a further listing against their names, which will also just add to the administrative complexities once there is a rescission of judgments. Then regarding slide 3 there, I think that indeed is a pertinent question which I think we will have to deal with in the deliberations on the bill. And then lastly, Chair, second lastly, sorry, then on slide 7 once again, there's a suggestion that the employee or judgment debtor should have the obligation to be involved as to when and how deductions start, continue, and cease. And I think that whilst we're all for protecting judgment debtors, this is inconceivable that the judgment debtor ultimately must have say in when deductions in terms of the EIO must start and stop. Lastly, Jay, slide 10 there raises the question of an offer being made for payment, and presumably we back at the consent to an EIO. So my comment will just be that we must just remember that this bill is ultimately to address the cycle or system of abuse of EIOs, and to suggest that we must go back to a situation where only your written consent is sufficient and exclude the judicial oversight this bill is looking to will be to defeat the purposes of this bill. I think the judgment ultimately leading to this bill made it quite clear that these consents, and I think when the Honorable Bongo was still there, he pointed out that sometimes these consents are even signed at the time of taking out the loan, if it is a microloan. So these consents, I think, must be precluded in the absence of judicial oversight. We cannot accede to the request that we must go back to the system of consents only. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Honourable Member, I thank you for pointing out to me that I have omitted, or rather made a grave mistake, by considering 9 months as 90 days. Quite a huge difference. The presentation speaks to 9 months, and that is what the intent was, and I think in answer to you as to why a magical number, you know, the verification process and contact process with a client in arrears has a certain cycle, and I think by saying at least 9 months gives both bank and, or rather creditor and debtor, the opportunity to make contact with each other, opportunity to perhaps discuss, and opportunity to make alternative arrangements, which, as we agree, the EIO is a drastic and invasive measure to recover your outstanding debt. And then on page 2, I must be, so in terms of the burden, why must the debtor have the burden to be involved, involved with notification to the employee or the garnishee? I think it's just a suggestion. What we're basically saying, that we're not saying that the debtor should be in a position to dictate when and how money will be deducted. See, what we're saying is the debtor should also be called upon to furnish information about the emolument attachment order to the garnishee, and not only leave the employer or the garnishee as the only person that is now tasked to make sure that the deductions are made, that the deductions are stopped and deductions are started, and then punish that garnishee also if, by way of the sanction, if that obligation is not fulfilled. What we're trying to say is include, make at least one other, preferably two other people, or persons, also accountable and involved. Just as far as beginning date and the end date is concerned. Or slide number 3, or chair, that was Honourable Member said that we'll look at that. Slide 7. Sorry, that's what I actually answered now. Slide 10, and I think I've left out one. Slide 10, Chair, the Honourable Member referred to the offer. I think I would like us to perhaps just submit one or two pointers on this, if you will allow us. I think the intent is here once again for us to make sure that the documentary evidence is submitted and actually exists, so that one can make sure that the offer that's agreed on by both parties are actually in fact the valid offer and conform to all the requirements. But with your permission, Chair, we may want to just explain that in more detail.
I think the door is also open for you to make further written submissions, but I think the department has really enough input to be able to take the process forward. I would like to ask Mr. Bassett to respond. You don't have to give a detailed response, but some of the things are just for noting for your consideration.
Thank you, Chair. We are going to be returning, dealing with all the responses in detail, so I would prefer not to go too much into the detail of what's been raised today. I do need to say that we've received received information, the comments that we've received, they are not all that straightforward, and there's some useful stuff even sitting here listening, which has been very productive, that we're going to have to go and ponder and set out in our departmental responses. So we have already started the process of summarizing the responses, and we need to give, especially what we've heard today, give consideration to some of the things that have come out here, and some of them are weighty issues, and we're going to have to deal with them carefully. What I really would like to say, Chair, is on the process that we followed, and this relates to the need or desirability of holding another colloquium or dialogue. We started this, well, I think it was in the Staying Capacity Assistive, I haven't got my facts correct, in about 2012. This board has been subjected to a huge consultation process. I think there have been three versions of this bill that have been processed over the years. And as a result of the first lot of consultation, the bill changed quite drastically in the second version, and as a result of the consultation thereafter changed again. So what I'm trying to say to you is that this bill has been subjected to a considerable amount of consultation, and maybe I could just leave it there. To hold a colloquium, I, from the department's point of view, I have my reservations, and as I said, this book has been the product of consultation. We worked, and I said that last week as well when we here presented the book, we worked very closely with DTI and the National Treasury as partners in state, and we've also listened to what other institutions and organizations have said. We haven't taken everything into consideration for reasons that we'll give when we come back here, and we've included all relevant stakeholders in that consultation process. So if I can leave it there, Chair, thank you very much.
I gather that the honourable members were also not in favour of another colloquium, because they think that this thing has been dragging on and everybody has had an opportunity to make an input. But perhaps even more important, the fact that we have left the door open for anybody to engage. You say, Mr. Juncker, is welcome to engage with you. I think the same applies to all the presenters. And from the committee, we would want the critical issues, just a summary thereof. We want to deploy members of parliament to go to different radio stations in different languages, explain to the broader public what is it that we are dealing with, what are the issues, so that we get a public debate on the medium, the ordinary people, and members of parliament then will be explaining this. And I think that will fill the gaps, if any gaps that are there. So if you could favor us with that type of a summary, and then our media department will arrange interviews, and then we take it forward from there. But as a committee, we value all contributions, because there are different angles to these issues we're dealing with. So there's no presentation which was not worthwhile, and we appreciate that, and we welcome all the presentations, submissions, and we say that even tomorrow, don't think that coming is a waste of our time. We have listened carefully, and we are going to take into consideration what you have raised. And, you can see the department is always open and available, and that for us as a committee is very important. And we thank you, Mr. Bassett, Vice President, and the President. So you are well excused. Members of Parliament, Portfolio Committee, there is a short report that should go to Parliament. I'm going to read that to yourself. Okay. Yesterday, we considered some court rules, and then the report on the outcome of that meeting reads as follows. Report of the Portfolio Committee of Justice and Correctional Services on the revised draft rules 2015 made in terms of Section 7, Subsection 3, of the Promotion of Administrative Justice Act 2000, Act 3 of 2000, dated 21st August 2016. The Portfolio Committee on Justice and Correctional Services, having considered the draft revised rules 2015 made in terms of Section 7.3 of the Promotion of Administrative Justice Act 2000, Act number 3 of 2000, referred to it, reports that it has agreed to revised draft rules without amendments. Report to be considered. Report of the Portfolio Committee on Justice and Correctional Services on the revised draft rules of procedure for application to court in terms of the Promotion of Access to Information Act 2000, Act 2000, dated 31st August 2015. The Portfolio Committee on Justice and Correctional Services, having considered the draft request rules of procedure for application to court in terms of the Promotion of Access to Information Act 2000, Act 2 of 2000, submitted to Parliament for approval in terms of Section 79, Section 3 of the Promotion of Access to Information Act and Fabric, reports that it has agreed to the revised rules without amendments. Report to be considered. Any comments, Honorable Horn?
No, thank you, Chair. Maybe just two technical things. I think the heading there of the first report must maybe be changed to be in line with the second one. The first one says revised draft rules, and the second one, in my opinion, correctly says draft revised rules. So if we can just maybe amend that, and then obviously it would be good to also just have the same portion bold technically in the second report as indicated in the first one. Thank you.
I agree with you, and thank you for the question.